what it is, Brad Lee back again with another episode of Dropping Bombs. Today in the studio, folks, I got a real treat. As always, Paul Hutchinson is in the house. What's happening, Paul?
Hey, Brad. Excited to be here.
For those of you guys that may not know who Paul is, because he's usually behind the scenes, he's been a little bit more in the public eye lately, but executive producer of Sound of Freedom, over 70 missions, rescuing children from child trafficking, and a philanthropist, because you fund a lot of things. But before that, you did all that, you were like a freaking successful business person. You said the you exited a company when it was worth $24 billion or under management.
Yeah, a little over $20 billion under management.
What kind of company?
It was an investment firm. We Bridge Investment Group is what it's known as today. Started out as Bridge Loan Capital. John Pennington and I started that, and then morphed into something much, much bigger. So we invested in real estate primarily.
When you sold, how much cash did you get in the bank?
Millions.
But I mean, like how many?
Many millions.
See, people don't realize, because when you hear someone's, you know, in other words, sometimes it's over-exaggerated. Sometimes you don't realize how much they actually got. But like you hear, oh, these guys sold for $6 billion. People think they got $6 billion. Well, 9 times out of 10, they don't.
No.
They got freaking equity that's worth this. They got this, they got that, but they only got a little bit of cash. So I'm always curious when people say, I exited, how much did you receive? How much did you call the bank? Because I want to call the bank one day and have it say, you have $1.4 billion in the bank.
Well, and a lot of people are confused on that. They say, you know Paul's a multi-billionaire because his company was worth $20+ billion. Well, assets under management is different than actual valuation of the company. The company was worth a few billion. In the beginning, John and I were 50-50 owners. But in order to build a successful company, we both realized that we didn't have the credibility, the background, the know-how, et cetera. And so we had this discussion, would you rather have a smaller piece of a massive pie or half of a smaller pie? You know, so just the two of us, we're only $10 million under management. We're doing all right. We're making $1 million a year. But then by the time we started bringing on some bigger partners, we were about $100 million under management. In fact, an interesting real size story, we brought on we brought on a guy by the name of Don Hartman. And Don came into my office 2 months after we hired him. This was late 2006. And
he said, where are you living right now?
Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay.
In fact, John and I wanted to build a world-class financial institution. And we thought, okay, do we need to move to New York? Do we need to move to California? And we thought, you know what? No, we want to build it here. We want to build it right here. And now we're by far the largest and most respected investment fund in our region, not just Utah. And so in the beginning, John tells a story all the time of who had a vision and what it was going to take to build it. And we'd be making phone calls. We had like a deal. We needed $25,000 by Friday. And I'd hang up the phone. I'd turn around. I said, John, we're going to be a $1 billion fund someday. I put my little pinky by my mouth. And John's like, Paul, we need $25,000 by Friday. And then we'd have a conversation at the end of the day. And he said, you know, we're not qualified to run a company that size. And I said, yeah, but if we build it with integrity, if we build it right from the beginning, and we have that vision of where we're going, we will attract the right people. So we did, you know, and we went from 50-50 ownership to then we brought on a whole team and both of us went down to 25% each. And then we augmented that with some real big players that we ended up going down to like 7.5% each. But I'd rather have 7% of a, you know, $20 billion under management than 50% of $10 million.
Yeah.
So we did really well.
So eventually you transitioned into philanthropy, like somehow saving kids and rescuing kids from being trafficked came up. Like you were a businessman. None of this was even a thing and blah, 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 blah. Where was the pivotal moment where you went, hey, I got to go help these kids that are being trafficked?
Well, interestingly, Brad, I that transition happened before I was successful. So I had a mentor when I was in my early 20s. I'm earning like $2,000 a month, right? And he said, Paul, he said, one of the biggest keys to success is charity. He said, make a decision today. He said, the average person only donates about 2% of their money to charity. He said, make a decision today that it's not 2%, it's 5, 10, 15, up to 20% of your money needs to go to charity. And I said to him, what? Okay, 20%, that's a lot. Right now, I'm only earning $2,000 a month, right? 20% of that, that's, I have to live on $1,600. I said, I would have to work extra hours just to be able to make it work. And he said, well, in addition to giving money, he said, I think you need to donate 20% of your time to charity. And I'm thinking, crap, what about work-life balance? You know, I've got to spend time with my family. I've got to build the company. I've got to do charity work, all of this stuff together. Well, I believe that that one decision of when I was broke to make a powerful, positive impact in the lives of others, I believe that that one decision made all the difference. I thought that I wanted to be successful so I could be charitable. I didn't realize that I should be charitable so that I could be successful. And that paradigm shift happened in my early 20s when I was still broke. But fast forward, I mean, perfect example. There's a big influencer named Glenn Beck, has a big radio show and a bunch of others. And he wanted to launch his anti-child trafficking campaign from Bangkok, Thailand. And it was going to cost $100,000 to get him and his team and everybody else there. But he had a massive audience, upwards of 50 million eyeballs and ears on all of his platforms. I thought, you know what? This is going to make a powerful impact in all of these people's lives. So, and at the time, the charity we were working with, we had a bunch of grandmas that were donating $5 a month. That was kind of sacred money. So I decided I was going to put that money in myself. Myself and my business partner, Don, put in the 100 grand. We flew them all to Thailand and back. As the plane was touching down in the U.S., as the wheels touched down and I got signal on my phone, I had two voicemail messages pop up. One of them was from a member of the Marriott family saying, Paul, I've been looking at your numbers. I want to put another $10 million into your senior housing fund. Another one was from Flying J Management with a bigger number. And my income from those two voicemail messages multiples exceeded what I had just barely put into the charity. And so I believe, how does somebody become a partner, let alone a founder of a 20 plus, 40 plus billion dollar investment fund? You're not a University of Utah dropout, right? The statistical probability of me being where I am is zero. The only way that I can understand it is that I made that decision in my early 20s that I was going to give until it hurt. And in doing so, you can call it God, you can call it the universe, you can call it karma, call it whatever you want to. There's a higher.
What do you call it?
I call it God. And we can get into that, because finding children in the most dangerous places in the world required that relationship every single time. But I believe that the windows of heaven opened up for me because of the fact that I was being a good steward with the money. I was making a difference, not just writing a check. I was putting my time into these charities. I served on multiple boards of directors for charities. In fact, guys, if you're raising money for a fund, the best place to meet rich people isn't it the gym, you know, isn't it a nice restaurant? It's doing charity work, right? On these fundraisers, these galas and stuff like that. I brought in hundreds of millions of dollars from those relationships, because when you get to that point where you're like, crap, I got an extra $1 billion laying around, You're figuring out ways to make an impact.
So are you continuously doing 20%? Have you increased it? Have you decreased it?
Way higher than that. I think last year we were closer to 80% last year.
Well, it's easier the more you have, right?
Of course. But I believe that the more I have came from give until it hurt when I didn't have. That made the difference.
Yeah, I'm somewhat of a generous fella. So I fancy myself that way anyway. So when I think 20%, like, how'd that hurt? But, you know, when you don't have but $2,000, well, that does hurt a little bit more, doesn't it?
It does. And that's the key. I think that, you know, there's a story in scriptures that talks about, you know, the widow's mite and how she just gave this one little teeny penny. But that meant so much because it was everything she had, right? So again, giving until it hurts. I think that's really the key, is say, okay, you know what? This is easy. Okay, whatever.
What about all the people that gave till it hurts and it hurt even worse than they thought it would? Mm-hmm. And they gave, in other words, when do you, like, take care of yourself?
Well, you have to always, I mean, you pay yourself first.
But if you had, if you, it sounded like you were doing 20% no matter what. So if you made $2,000 and you had rent due and you didn't have the money to pay rent, you still gave the money. And who'd you give the money to? I mean, that was only $400. Who'd you give it to?
Well, that's a crazy part of it as well. I mean,
how do you know? And then now, how do you know who to give it to?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, I'm like, okay, I need to give money, so I'm downtown and I'm finding some guy on the street that's asking me for money, and I'm thinking to myself, you know what, this guy probably. And I was a judgmental bastard a little bit. I was like, okay, this guy probably made a whole bunch of bad decisions in his life, and now he's asking me for drug money. It didn't feel right. Now, you know, I've matured to the point where I've realized that, you know, sometimes things happen that are outside of our control, but I had to make a decision back then of what really felt right to me. And for me, children, the truly innocent, that a 9-year-old child in a position completely outside of any decisions that he or she made.
Yeah.
That felt like the right kind of charity. So I was on the Make-A-Wish board of directors for 7 years. I was the incoming chairman for Make-A-Wish in our area when I got a phone call from our attorney general in Utah. And he said, Paul, he said, I know that you're super passionate about giving back, about charity, and specifically children, because that's all of my charity work that I've been doing. He said, I need to talk to you about something that's really dark. He said, it's the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world, and good people don't even know that it's happening. And I'm like, what's the fastest growing? Like, you know, drugs and, you know, guns, whatever. He said, it's human trafficking. He said, and particularly child trafficking. I'm like, child trafficking? What is it? I mean, people selling kids? What are they selling kids for? He's like, you know, organ harvesting, labor, sex. And to me at the time, it didn't even register. I'm like, how in the world is there even a demand for something like that? And then he told me a story of a Homeland Security agent who was in Colombia at the time. And the movie Sound of Freedom, you know, is based on this little, you know, situation here where he said this guy has some children he identified in Colombia, about 20 kids in Cartagena that he wanted to rescue. It was going to cost him like $50,000 to pull these kids out. And the government wouldn't give him the money to do so because he couldn't prove that there was any Americans involved. And I'm like, you know what?
Is that really why, though?
Here's what happened. That very same week that he asked for that, there was a Hewlett-Packard's fake manufacturing plant situation in China or something. And they paid $50,000 to that agent to go do that sting. Yet they wouldn't do the $50,000 for the kids here. You know, and that's a whole, I mean, we can go 2 hours on a podcast about that one question. Is that really the reason? I believe that there's people all the way up the chain that are involved in this stuff.
So do I. I don't even believe it. I know it.
Yeah.
There has to be. There's no other explanation for the stupidity that surrounds it.
Yeah, I believe.
And not only that, people have been busted. Like I forget.
The PDD thing just came out, and there's all kinds of stuff that's coming out.
I don't look into that stupidity because I can't. I only pay attention to what I can control, or at least I try to. So like when I hear about P. Diddy, first of all, it's the media. Can't trust the media, period. So I don't know that they're lying. Maybe they're trying to set him up. I don't know. Let's say he is a dirtball. I don't know why. I'm not there. I don't know him. I don't know what's going on. I'm not going to believe the media just because someone is said to do this. Like right now, if they just came out and said, hey, man, Paul, he was humping kids too. He was a victim. He did it. Well, I'm not going to believe it. It may be true, but I'm not going to believe it because the media said it. And once I know the media lies, and I know they do, then I can't trust it. So I'm not going to trust it just because I want to. You know, hey, P. Diddy, I knew that son of a bitch. Well, that's called a hater. You're just jumping on a bandwagon. You wanted him to be guilty of something. Well, I don't want him to be guilty of anything. I hope he's not guilty. But I can't trust the mainstream media is my point.
For sure.
So when you see it in the mainstream media, you can't trust it, unfortunately. Even with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, again, you can use your gut, you know. You can have a little feeling about it like Epstein. Dude, it was clear Epstein had a lot of dirt on a lot of people because he videotaped powerful people humping little kids or each other or dudes. Like, dude, you know, it could have been a completely consensual relationship. There was no child trafficking involved. We got it all twisted, but it was a encounter they don't want released. So Epstein, I believe, had a lot of power that he normally shouldn't have had. Very similar to where I think China's got some power over certain politicians. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, dude, it's corrupt.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they don't do a bunch of, like, this episode won't even get much play. Why? Because we're talking about child trafficking. And for some reason, they want to take that shit off YouTube and not talk about it. I don't understand. How would nobody want to talk about it? And ironically, I'm the same as you. When I think, who should I help? Yes, I feel bad about homeless people, but guess what? I used to be homeless, number one. Number two, I met a lot of homeless people 9 times out of 10. It's their choice they're homeless. They don't want to clean up. They don't want to go home. They don't want to do right. They want their drugs. They want their shit. And, hey, they're willing to sacrifice being homeless. So you give them money, and you're right. It goes right to go drugs and everything else they choose to do. They're not in a situation where they have to be there. They're choosing to be there. That, to me, is a waste of money. Kids. And the reason why is because I got a DUI once, and I had to do community service. And the community service they put me in was a juvenile home. And part of the microfilm, they called it microfiche, I had to go and alphabetize because it was out of order and whatnot. So I would have to read a little bit of stuff to put it in the right categories. And I was reading about little kids, dude, getting cigarettes put out on them. Their parents, you know, putting them in closets and just throwing them like a box of cereal for a week at a time because they're on heroin and shit. The most crazy shit you can't even believe. And I thought, dude, see, they are truly helpless. They don't have any choice whatsoever. That's who needs my help.
Yeah.
So I started picking little kids to help as well, but I didn't ever go crazy, like, you know, go to Cartagena and, or what is it?
Yeah.
Wherever.
It's Cartagena, Colombia.
Yeah. And risk my life getting them out of the freaking dark recesses of the sex trade. Although I would. Again, I mean, next time you go, let me know. Shit, I'll put on a mustache and go down there. But I don't want to. I heard about what you guys do, and it's like it's not as fun as it sounds. Matter of fact, it's quite dangerous, and the reward isn't you're kicking in doors and, you know, putting two in the head of some dude that's about ready to stick it in. Like, that's what I'm hoping for. It's not that, is it? But anyway, I don't want to get too far. Hold on, you're getting me excited. Let me go back. So. You're running around, you're saying, hey, I gotta give, and you think the giving is why you've succeeded beyond explanation. And then at some point you said, hey, I want to start helping these kids. And then at some point you said, okay, I'm going to sell and go put a lot of money into this. What were you doing, and how much were you making at that point?
I was making millions of dollars a year just on my salary and the GP distributions, et cetera.
So you had all the cars, all the houses, or no?
I had a basketball court in my basement, right? I had parties at my house. I had all of the NBA players that were in the area with 150 beautiful women at parties at my house, right? I had 450 people inside my house for a Halloween party. Right, that's the kind of
Salt Lake City.
In Salt Lake, yeah, it was beautiful.
So it must have been the Jazz players.
Yeah, it was all the Jazz players. I had Rudy call. In fact, I had Donovan Mitchell called me. He's like, bro, he says, can we use your house again for another party? You know, that's the kind of like. And some of my parties too. I'd invite the senators and the congressmen and, you know, all these who's who people. And if I forgot somebody who was thinking they were who's who, I'd get a text. Hey, so and so is worried that they pissed you off for some reason. They didn't get invited to your party, right? So that was the energy. And realize this too, Brad. One of the reasons I was asked and why I was so effective at some of those early undercover rescue missions, I wasn't going in as the, you know, the Green Beret and whatever else. I was going in because of the fact that I was Paul fucking Hutchinson, right? I had a massive ego and big money, and I had a $50,000 watch when I went on my first rescue mission, $2,000 cufflinks. You know, I got this phone call from the Homeland Security agent that I was helping to fund some of the stuff. And he said, hey, Paul, I'm in Cartagena. There's not just 20 children. There's more than 50 here and more than 100 in the surrounding areas. We have a plan that we could rescue all of them one day. But I'd love your help if you're willing. And I said, well, how much do you need? You know, I'll write a check. And he said, we need you. Could you be in Colombia in 2 days? I'm like, you need me? And he knew more about my background than most people. He knew that I could handle myself in a dangerous situation.
Why?
But I'd been taking a lot of Krav training and a bunch of stuff like that. And I always felt like I'd be involved in a war, but I never served in the military, but I got damn good at everything. You know, my spread at 20 yards on a pistol is just like this every single time. I'm really good. Well, but the biggest reason he wanted me to come down had nothing to do with that. He said the head trafficker down here has a piece of property, wants to develop into a child brothel sex resort. He needs a few million dollars to make it happen. And somehow we need to get him to call all the other traffickers and get them to bring all their children to the same place on the same day. He said, we believe that he'll do that if he thinks that the only way that you're going to fund his Jeffrey Epstein Island resort thing he wants to build, the only way that you're going to fund it is if he can prove to you that he has the inventory. And we already identified that he has it. And so you're going to come down, just say, hey, I'm... Now, here's the crazy thing. All of this 70-plus missions later, I was Paul Stone, Paul Steele, Paul Black. That first one, he said, can you be in Colombia in 2 days? They didn't have time to set up a fake profile or anything. I went down as Paul Hutchinson. And they looked online and showed my, you know, I had a nice lifestyle. So he showed my social media and stuff. And I got pictures of me with Lambos and Ferraris and yachts and all this crap, right? And so I get down there and my energy is this arrogant Paul F. and Hutchinson. That's what made it work. That's what these guys are looking for. These traffickers are looking for guys who just have egos bigger than life itself, who are paying for these freaking parties. And so that's why it worked. For the first year and a half, I was playing the role of the wealthy playboy. And these traffickers would bring all of the other traffickers together. And we had very, very successful rescue missions because of that. But here's the crazy thing. The first time I met traffickers, I thought that they would have, you know, a bunch of tattoos and earrings in their noses. The first trafficker I met was a businessman, clean cut, polo shirt, looks like you and I, right? I'm like, this doesn't make sense. And the second one was a beautiful woman that ran a modeling agency and whatever. But the common thread of all of the missions I did, the common thread with all of the traffickers and all the perpetrators, the common thread was arrogance, greed, and lust. And so a few years into it, I made a massive transition in my own life because I looked in the mirror and I said, okay, you're not doing illegal stuff. You're not, for sure not, you know, you're rescuing kids, you're not trafficking kids, but how is ego and greed and lust affecting your relationships? How is it affecting everything in your life? And so I made a hard pivot about 7-8 years ago. And change that part of my life so that I could be a man of integrity in business and in bed. And that was important in my life.
In business and in what?
And in bed.
What does that mean?
A lot of us say, you know, I'd never screw somebody over in business. You know, I've got this perfect whatever else, but these guys are cheating on their wives, right? They're not living in integrity in every part of their life. And so there's a...
Were you? Why'd you have to make a change?
Because I wasn't.
So you were what?
I was on the end of my second marriage.
So you were cheating?
Of course.
So you were out there gallivanting.
I was.
I call it gallivanting.
I was. And it was affecting everything. I thought super successful. You know, I can have these parties. I can sleep with whoever I want to, whatever. But that lack of integrity in that area of my life, that would have been fine if I was single dude. But I wasn't. Right? And so seeing that...
Why weren't you? Why didn't you just get divorced?
As I lived in a religious background, that divorce was really bad. Would have been way better than doing
on your second marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was a matter after the first one's done, you already did it. Might as well do it again.
Screwed up. Yep.
Did you like... Were you gallivanting? So you were like banging a lot of chicks? Do you find that chicks... As soon as they find out you have money, are willing to do whatever?
For sure. For sure. When you live in that house and you're having those parties and you're that guy, you know, girls are like, oh, yeah, so who are you? Oh, this is your house? This is your party?
Do you think they do it because they think they're going to get it? Or is they're just enamored by the success?
I think there's a little bit of both.
Because I always wonder, like, why would you do that, dude? Do you think he's going to give you all his money or you think he's just going to buy you nice shit?
Probably the second. I don't think they think they can get all the way to give.
Well, that's pretty easy if you ask me, though. Like, yeah. Just buy me nice shit and I'll do you. Like, come on.
Yeah.
But so.
In my life now, yeah, I'm married to. Let me just put it this way. I was in Haiti. I was actually at a funeral. One of my operators got killed, and I had done a bunch of undercover
on a mission.
It was because of the mission. Some of the guys that we took down were super high level political. It was a mess. I was at that funeral, and she was this. I was divorced. I was trying to figure out what I wanted in my life, and I met this woman. She's now my wife. She was donating her time at the orphanage, one of the orphanages that was taking care of some of the kids that we rescued. And I tell people meeting a beautiful Colombian actress is kind of cool, but when she's donating her time at an orphanage in Haiti, that's freaking amazing. And what's interesting is you back up a few months, Tony Robbins gave me a call and he said, "Hey, Paul, I know that you know Glenn Beck and had done some stuff with him. I think that it would be awesome to have Glenn come to one of my UPW events." I said, "Yeah, cool. I'll give Glenn a call." So I called Glenn and we went to Tony's event. Tony had seen one of the rescues that we had done and it just rocked his world. And so I'm there and Tony's events, he has this part where he helps you visualize where you want to be in your business, like super clear. Like he emotionally takes you there and you write down for about 2 hours in one of the sessions where you're writing down in detail what this part of your business looks like and what it's going to feel like and how you're going to feel yourself, et cetera. And I realized I had done all of these things to build my companies, but I had never done that in my personal life. I had never really written down what I wanted. So I did. I was married at the time, my second marriage, and I wrote down in detail, this is how my wife shows up for me. This is how I show up for her. This is how our interaction with our kids and list. And then something inside me said, "Paul, don't put her in that situation. Instead, change it to the woman in my life." And that's what I did. And I wrote in detail, pages and pages and pages, what that relationship looked like with the woman in my life. Well, it was that very night I found out some things that told me she was not the one. And so we ended up, filing for divorce. That was pretty quick. It was only a 1-year marriage. And then just a couple months later, I end up being in Haiti. And every single thing that I wrote on that list, I tell my wife, I says, "I created you," right? I wrote down all of the stuff that I wanted and boom, it was there. But part of it was that I had gone through the dark night of the soul myself. I had done some deep work. In fact, one of the things that really changed my life, and this is, I'm dropping a bomb here, right? I had a call from one of my undercover operators and he said, "We're super close." And he said, "Paul, do you trust me?" I said, "Yeah, I trust you with my life." He said, you need to come to my house on Saturday night, fast that morning, eat super healthy beforehand. He said, "I have a lady who's a doctor, who's been traveling the world, who's a specialist in understanding plant medicine and using different types of plant medicine to help people work through their trauma." I'm like, "I don't have any trauma." He's like, "Bullshit. You're in a disastrous marriage." He says, "Your second one." He says, "You need to fix some shit in your life." And so back in the late 60s, President Nixon, I believe it was, decided to take a whole bunch of things and throw them under the bus. I'm talking about psychedelics, things like psilocybin and sassafras and white lily, etc., labeling them as Schedule I drugs. And so we've been taught our whole lives these things are as dangerous as cocaine. No, they're safer than table sugar, but you need to be using them with a trained facilitator who really knows how to make things work. And that experience transformed me. I could feel in every cell of my body. It was dark, it was heavy, but from an empathy standpoint, I could feel in every cell in my body the pain that my children felt when I cheated on their mom. I could feel it. It was as if I was them, and it was so heavy and it was so dark, but it was so beautiful to feel this transition of me washing away all that filth and all that crap of my life and coming to this place where I could finally qualify for a woman like Vanessa in my life. So that's a whole other story. But for me, That was transformational. So we tried changing a bunch of laws. Utah was this close to being the first state in the country to not only decriminalize, but fully legalize the use of psychedelics in trauma therapy. But they're waiting until it's actually approved by the FDA. So we have healing retreats in Latin America that I help facilitate. And I've helped to facilitate over 50 now of these guided meditation healing retreat experiences. I believe that that's one of the keys to eradicating child trafficking, because just going in and pulling these kids out of hell is never going to fix the problem. We've got to fix our own trauma, and we need to do it globally so that people aren't growing up and doing these things because they're so broken inside.
Is that why you think they're doing it?
I believe that's a big piece of it.
Maybe they're just evil.
No.
Or pervy. No.
The majority, almost every single one of the guys that we arrested, almost every one of them were raped as children themselves.
What happens to these people when they get arrested?
We tell the government, whatever government we're working with, we say, listen, we will do all the work. We will pay for everything. We will give you all the credit. Your people will think you're heroes because we're going to be undercover. They're going to think that we got arrested. All we ask for is that these guys stay in jail for good. They don't get around your system. And number two, we have full access to the kids and getting them rehabilitated and back to their families, et cetera. Now, in most situations, they get life in prison. We let them plea down to 25 years in exchange for information on all the Americans that have been down there so that then we can take down the perpetrators as well. In some situations, they get around the system. We did an operation in Haiti, took down some of the top traffickers in the entire country, rescued 34 children, and represented hundreds more. Those were just the ones they brought to the party. Well, 2 weeks later, these guys paid $80,000 to be let out of prison. Now, to put that in perspective, the average income in Haiti was like $500 a year. $80,000 is like billions.
Who'd they pay? Barbecue?
Four corrupt judges got paid off. And so, and at that point, these corrupt judges had to, you know, make up this story about who the real bad guys were. And there was something that went wrong on one of the missions there where I got taken in by a police officer who didn't know that I was a good guy. And so my real information was on the record there. And so fast forward, they're like, you know, the real bad guy got away. It was that Paul Hutchinson guy, because my actual real name was there on the records and stuff as part of it. And so we had to fly the first lady, a bunch of diplomats to the U.S. and we showed them the entire case, A to Z. And the head of the police stands up and he's like, I don't care if I lose my job. I don't care if I lose my life. I'm going to fix the corruption in my country. And so they went back in. They arrested those judges. They arrested the traffickers. And it created a lot of the civil unrest that you're still seeing today in Haiti with this power struggle that ended up assassinating the president, ended up killing one of my operators there. All of that crap that's going on there happened because there was such corruption there, and these traffickers were so high level, and they wanted to make sure that they were still out on the streets doing what they were doing.
It was not solved there.
It's not. I'm not going back. That place is a cesspool.
Dude, there's a guy that's running it named Barbecue. You heard of that?
I haven't heard of Barbecue. I've been out of the Haiti thing for the last couple of years. I've seen some of the news. It's a mess.
Well, I know people that are going in and getting Americans out.
Yeah.
And I was talking to him about it, and there's some, you know, gangster named Barbecue, and he's in charge of the whole country. Like, you go to Haiti, dude, Barbecue runs Haiti, and it's not the government. It's a gang.
Yeah.
So like, if anybody goes to Haiti, dude, they got balls of steel.
Yeah.
But anybody that goes into these situations, in my book, has balls of steel. That's why you guys use a lot of operators. You know, Green Beret, Navy SEALs, all these ex-military badasses are the ones going in there. How come these child traffickers don't recognize that?
Well, here's the thing. The best undercover operators aren't the Navy SEALs, Green Berets. They're guys like Jimmy and Andy and Jeremy and myself, ultra-successful businessmen who had big-ass egos, who had training in hand-to-hand. The Green Berets, a lot of those guys, they need night vision goggles and a sniper on the roof to really do their gig, right? You need to be able to handle a situation with your bare hands. And if the audience hasn't heard of Krav Maga, most martial arts, you know, not to make fun of them, but a lot of them are bow to your sensei and 3 points when you kick them in the leg, right? Krav is brick to their head, go home to your family. It's Israeli special forces hand-to-hand combat training. It's the most lethal on earth. Every move, they don't see, they don't talk, they don't walk. You know, my guys can take away a gun. I've been trained to take away a gun faster than they can pull the trigger every single time. And so that's the kind of skill sets that you need. But the most important part is that ego self. In fact, I'll tell you an example. One of the times in Haiti, I went in, we were, it was funny. This is another one we took Glenn with. And I had, my son had been on a 2-year service mission. And while he was gone, I had left the church and divorced his mom. So he was trying to figure out if I was a good guy or not. So he gets back after 2 years. It's on a Tuesday. Thursday, 2 days later, I put him on a Gulfstream jet. We fly back to Texas where he served his mission, pick up Glenn back, go to Haiti, and he's filming a bunch of the kids in the orphanages that were rescued there. And it was like 3 days into a Saturday night. It was about 10 o'clock at night. We're leaving at 6 a.m. the next morning going back to the U.S. And the Homeland Security agent who first recruited me, he said, Paul, he said, I've had teams on the ground for the last 5 days. Nobody has found any leads, any connections with traffickers. You're the best I have. Can you go out with them? I knew that meant I'd get no sleep. So I go out that night and connected with the top traffickers in the whole country. And we sit down the next morning. I'll tell you how I did in a second. The next morning, we're on the jet. There's me, there's Tim, there's Glenn Beck, there's my son. This is my crowning moment, right? And one of the Navy SEALs that was out with us the night before had given him all the details. So he sits there and Tim sits there. He shakes his head. He's like, in 14 years working with Homeland Security, FBI, CIA agents, the best undercover operator I've ever seen is Paul Hutchinson. And my son's sitting there, right? And Glenn Beck turns to me and he's like, Paul, why is that? You've never had any government training. Why are you so good at this? And I said, well, number one, I'm the kind of energy these traffickers are looking for. I don't have any tattoos. I'm not big and bulky. I'm just me, right? I can deal with stuff with my bare hands, but it's that ego energy they're looking for. I said, but here's another thing. Just this goes back to you asked, you know, who I believe that it is, and it's God. I said, let me tell you what happened last night. We're out. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. Hadn't found any connections at all. And I said, guys, can I take lead? Are you good with that? And these guys are, you know, they're chewing tobacco and hearing some big, you know, tattoos and whatever, former Green Berets and Navy SEALs. And one of them says, yeah. They say you're really good at this. I want to see what you do. I said, okay. I said, you need to follow exactly what I say. I said, first things first, this isn't a religious conversation, but I need you to understand that I believe in God. Most people believe in a supreme being. Some people call him the universe and he and she and the mountain, whatever, doesn't matter. I said, God exists and cares more about these children than you and I ever could and knows exactly where they are. So if you're okay with it, even if you're not, I'm going to start out by asking for some help. So here we are, downtown Port-au-Prince, Haiti, the most voodoo-infested place in the Western Hemisphere. And we take off our hats and offer up a prayer. And then I said, guys, now I need you to understand how I see fear and faith. Most people think that faith is going to church and asking God to fix things in their life they don't believe are going to be fixed. That's not faith. Faith is that's blind hope. I said, faith is an element. It's a principle of power. It's the most powerful law in the universe. This is how I built my companies. This is we're going to be a $1 billion fund, right? It's this clear visualization. Faith is this unwavering conviction that what I want to have happen will happen. Most people have a hard time with unwavering conviction about anything. Should I marry this woman? Should I start this new job? Whatever. Because they don't know if it's in line with what their God wants, right? For me, it's easy for me to believe that there's no higher power in the universe that's okay with an 8-year-old being sold for sex. There's not anyone out there. And so it's easy for me to believe that my creator wants me to find these kids. So I have that unwavering conviction. And I said, guys, have you seen the movie Finding Nemo? You know, in the second one, Finding Dory, the stupid fish, this 2-second memory, and her parents are somewhere in the ocean complex. I said, I might operate a little bit like Dory tonight because I'm not going to operate on logic and protocol. I'm going to be listening. In fact, I have a book coming out. The first one is about the Sound of Freedom movie, and that'll be coming out in about a month and a half. Later this year, I have one coming out called Are You Listening? Because in this world where we're so inundated with fake news and fake media and all this other crap, we need to learn how to identify truth. And every single one of us were born with the ability to do so. And all we have to do is quiet our mind and listen to that still small voice of truth that is coming from our higher self, from God, whatever. And that's exactly how I was able to find these kids. I said, they're like, okay, dude, whatever. I said, okay, just drive, drive. They're driving. I said, okay, stop right there. He said, the black alley, the motorcycle gang. I said, yeah, right there. That guy knows something. He said, we have to survey the area. This is super dangerous. I said, no, we don't have time for that. In fact, you guys are going to intimidate him. You guys need to stay in the car. I'm going to go out myself. And this guy's like, what, are you stupid, Paul? I said, look, I'll buy you pink panties when we get home. I don't have 2 weeks to find kids. I got tonight. And that guy knows something. So I get out of the car. I walk up to him. He pulls up his shirt and there's a gun. Shows me a gun that's tucked into his pants. And I'm just listening. I pull out a $100 bill, which is a shit ton of money there, right? Pull out $100, I give it to him. He says, what's that for? I says, that's for you. You keep it. I said, I have another one for you. You can help me with something. I got a buddy. He's got a lot of money. He likes 10-year-olds. He sets me up if I set him up. You connect me with somebody who's got what he wants, I'll give you another $100 right now. Boom. He gets on the phone call, makes a call, connects me with this lady who owns a strip club that was selling kids. Boom. We worked our way up that night to connecting with the top traffickers in the entire country that ended up in that big rescue sting mission. So there's a lot of detours.
Aren't you worried that someone might be like us? And because if you came to me and wanted a 10-year-old, I'd smash your face in.
It's happened. But that has happened
when you guys were trying to connect with traffickers.
We were coming down from Tijuana and through Ensenada area on the way down there. There's a place called Rosarita Beach, and we were out, and I'm out on the beach, and I'm talking to the guys that are selling me, you know, chains and jewelry and crap. And one of them says, "Hey, what do you want? You don't want this? You want some blow? You want some weed?" I said, no, yeah, we're looking for something else, you know. He says, what are you looking for? I says, you know, girls, we're looking for a party and whatever. He goes, well, there's a strip club right there. I'm like, I said, no, abuelas. That means grandmas, right? He goes, abuelas, they're like 19, 20 years old. He goes, I said, abuelas. You know, as I'm trying to help him see what we're looking for so we can, and he says, what, you looking for like 12, 13-year-old? And I just raised my one eyebrow, and he went like this. Just like that, mad as hell, right? And he starts yelling to all these guys around us. Now, I've got my Krav Maga trainer there with me. And he's like, Paul, I can't defend us against a bunch of good Mexicans, and I don't want to beat up a bunch of good Mexicans. We got to get out of here, right? So we hightailed out before we got the shit beat out of us. But yeah, this happened.
Or that would blow your cover.
Yeah.
Dude, I'd almost it almost scare me that I would be associated with or mixed up with it, because, you know, it's real easy with the media nowadays for people to call, well, you know, you're acting like you're down there saving them, you're down there fucking them. And it's almost like, damn, dude, that's a risky, because you don't want to be caught in that situation.
Of course.
You go to prison as a child molester, you're in some trouble.
Exactly.
And this is why I don't understand, like, dude, like, who would sell a child? Like, again, they're helpless. And I ain't talking about a 16-year-old prostitute. Because, again, if they're willing to do it and they're doing it, and, again, forced to do it, to me, is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There are, and I'm not talking about where they're forced to do it, they're going to get killed, so they do it voluntarily. That's forced in my book.
Yeah.
But then there's also, you know, prostitution, to where the girl's 17. That's technically a child. I'm talking about the 10-year-olds, the 12-year-olds, the 13-year-olds, and younger. What's the youngest you've seen?
Oh, we've had as young as 8 years old that were being sold for sex, and younger than that for organ harvesting.
And organ harvesting, that's murder.
Yeah, that's super dark.
I mean, that's worse. That's worse to me. Actually, no, I don't know if it's worse. It's
If I had a 9-year-old and I had to choose between her getting killed from them taking her organs or her getting raped for the next 10 years, I would take the first option. I would. I'm like, okay, she's in a better place. She's not going through trauma every single day. And Brad, the thing that changed my life completely was that first operation. There's two different things that happened that changed everything. the very first day that I'm there, we're sitting at this table negotiating about this party, and one of the traffickers leans forward and he says, "Pablo, I have a gift for you." I said, "Really, what's your gift?" And he hands me his phone, and there's a picture of an 11-year-old girl in his phone. He said, "This is Princess. She's still a virgin. We just took delivery of some. She's my gift for your party." Now, in the movie Sound of Freedom, my character is Pablo de Gallo, and I'm the rich guy, and the only way that that Jim Caviezel convinces me to go is he gives this picture of this little 11-year-old girl to my driver, and looking at that picture, that convinced me to go. In real life, I was already there. I was face to face with these traffickers and negotiating this party, but looking at this, knowing that this was a traffic child, him telling me she's a virgin, she's 11, and telling the horrible things I do to this child, that galvanized my commitment to fund whatever I needed to make this happen. Well, fast forward a couple weeks later, we're there in the actual sting. These guys had brought 54 children to Cartagena. There was a total of over 120 children in the three cities, largest child rescue operation in one day that I knew of at the time, of children. And we're sitting there at this table. I'm negotiating everything. They had brought these kids. We put them in a separate part of the house. And one of the traffickers stands up and he goes, "Pablo, I have to show you the gifts that I brought you." And he goes in the house where the children were. And immediately we could hear a few of the children crying. They were, something was happening, was traumatizing them. It was fear. It was a cry of fear. And about 10 minutes later, he comes out and he has four children, three little girls, one little boy, all virgins. This little boy was 11 years old. They gave him cocaine that morning because he was so scared. What kind of fucked up monster thinks that that's attractive? Every cell in my body wanted to hug these kids and say, "You're going to be fine. You're going to see your parents again." I couldn't say that. I'm sitting on a chair. I'm literally shorter than I am on this chair. I'm sitting on a chair, and this girl, this 11-year-old girl, the same one he showed me in the picture, they bring her out and she's standing in front of me. And our eyes are almost level with her standing up and me sitting down. And all I could see was fear in her eyes. She was so scared. And I said, "Como te llamas? What's your name?" And she didn't know her name. She knew it. She didn't say it, probably because her real name wasn't Princess. She was trying to figure out what the traffickers wanted her to say. And I took her little hands. She was shaking. And I just said, "Esta bien. It's okay." That was the hardest moment for me, is seeing that. And I turned to the traffickers. I said, "Guys, not time for the party yet. We still need stuff to discuss here. Send the kids back in." The most beautiful moment of my life up to that point was after the agents came, stored the party, Child Protective Services people came in with the children. And they started laughing. They started singing with the children. And that sound of freedom, that singing versus the crying that we heard half an hour before, that was the most beautiful sound that I ever heard. That's why we named the movie The Sound of Freedom. Was that sound of singing that they did with those kids. And I turned to the agent that was with me and I said, "I've spent my whole life making rich people richer, and myself, one of those rich people, right? I want to make a difference." I actually had a white Lamborghini Aventadora convertible that I was planning on buying that next month. It was on my bucket list, right? It was $350,000+. I said, "Guys, I'm not going to buy that car. I'm going to write you a check instead. You tell me what you need." And he said, "Paul," he said, "unfortunately, the majority of demand for parties like this comes from wealthy guys with big egos, just like you." He said, "If you're willing to be the bait, I'll change your whole life." And that's the transition. But seeing that child right there, I couldn't imagine. How in the hell does somebody get to the point where they think that's attractive? How does somebody get to the point where they think that it's okay to traumatize a child like that over and over again? So yeah, I sold everything. I got out of my company and I said, "Okay, I'm full-time charity. My whole life, the rest of my life, I'm full-time charity."
Powerful, brother. Powerful. And I'll tell you, number one, is there a place where people can support that?
Would love that. I would be so
grateful. Where would they go?
So grateful. Two places. Number one, you can go to the Child Liberation Foundation, which is just liberatechildren.org. And you can get involved there. You can donate $1 a month, $5 a month, $100 a month, whatever, or just a one-time donation. If you want to get involved and say, "Hey, you know what? We're building the safe house right now for the 111 kids. If you want to say, "Hey, I want to be the guy that pays for 111 beds, for those kids, awesome. That would be great, you know. And then every single penny, you know, isn't getting taken into administration stuff. It's going directly to the cause, which is fantastic. Number two, the bigger picture of eradicating child trafficking isn't just fighting fire with fire, isn't just rescuing the kids, isn't just handling that. It's figuring out how to change global consciousness, help heal humanity. And so I started actually a for-profit called Liberating Humanity. You can go to liberatinghumanity.com. You can find me on all social medias under Liberating Humanity, and liberating.humanity, I think is what it is, and get a whole bunch of information on how to keep your kids safe, how to heal from your own trauma, how us as adults can deal with our own bullshit and move forward. So, you know, guys say, you know, I've got bullshit I'm dealing with, but I'm not trafficking kids. Yeah, you're affecting it in some way. Here's what's happening. You're a business owner. Some guy's got a, you know, he's got 50 employees, or whatever else, but he's dealing with unresolved trauma of his own. He needs to work through, and he goes to work, and there's a young guy that's there, and he's yelling at him and treating him like shit. Well, that young guy happens to have a 5-year-old at home. That young guy's already addicted to hardcore pornography and is now looking at child pornography and wants to act out whatever, right? And that trauma transfer happens. I promise you that every time you act out in a state of anger or frustration, whatever else, that trauma transfer will happen. And so by fixing our own shit, then we can make the world a healthier place for children all the way around. So even if you're not participating in that, if you're playing in that energy in any way, then that's what Liberating Humanity is about. So if they can go to Liberating Humanity, in fact, you can pre-sign up for my book. It's the Child Liberation Series. Book one is the story behind The Sound of Freedom and the details of that rescue mission and all the stuff that wasn't even in the movie and a bunch of others. And then, of course, we've got the Are You Listening and the other child rescue mission books coming out later this year.
So go get involved however you see fit. Obviously, if you're one of these traumatic people and need one of these healing places, go as well.
Yeah, you can sign up right there on Liberating Humanity. You can sign up to actually come to the healing retreat, or if you got a shit ton of money and you want to invest in things, I can show you how investing together in these healing retreats can create as high of a return or higher than what we paid in Bridge in the real estate company.
Now, in the green room, you were talking about you're an expert at manifestation, like making things happen. You can talk about, you know, you had 4,000 employees at one point. You can talk about how to build a business. Mainly entrepreneurs listen to this, but again, I'm finding all kinds of people listen to this podcast. So my question would be for the entrepreneurs listening, what are some things Paul Hutchinson can give them to help them build their business?
Absolutely. Well, this is what I love. I was a mentor for many years with young entrepreneurs. Number one, and the most important of every how-to that you can learn, is you've got to clearly identify your why on everything, whether it's getting in good shape, getting a six-pack, whether it's building your companies, whether it's having a healthy family. If you can't clearly identify your why, then all the how in the world isn't going to matter.
So how do you find your why?
Sometimes you got to go look at things you don't want until you realize what you want. You know, I didn't know I wanted a house with a basketball court in my basement until I went into one that was being built. And I'm like, this is cool as shit.
Right? Well, yeah, but anyone can do that. Like, yeah. Everybody wants a G700.
No, not really. How bad do they want it? Why do they want it? Right?
Well, the why they want it?
Yeah.
Because it's cool.
It's cool, yeah. But the thing is, if they can solve
their trauma.
If your dream isn't big enough to make it so you don't have to wake up at an alarm clock in the morning, then you need a bigger dream. You need to find something that just motivates you. And different people are motivated by different things. I remember I was building a company and I had an employee named Robert. Robert was brilliant and broke. And he was a really good closer. He was fantastic. But he would sell enough in the first 3 days of the month to completely cover all of his bills for the month. And then he would suck. The rest of the month would just nosedive.
Why do you think that is, though?
Because he saw himself as a $30,000, $40,000 a year guy instead of a $500,000 a year guy.
That's right.
And so I said, Robert, I said, come with me this afternoon. Just get off the phone. I'll pay you for today. Come with me. I said, if every car in the world would cost $1, what would you buy? He says, it was stupid. For him, it was important, right? It was one of those vans that had the high top on it, the back could turn into a bed and all this stuff. And I'm like, no, that wasn't my dream. But anyway, but he thought, that'd be cool. So I took, I said, have you ever driven one? Oh, no, I couldn't afford one of those. I said, yes, you can. You could buy one in 1 month if you kept up what you do the first 3 days of the month. So we went and we, for the first time ever, he got to drive his dream car. And I says, can you see yourself? Can you see yourself in this? And finally he couldn't. And then I said, okay, if every house in the world costs a dollar, where would you live? And he told me, so we went up to that neighborhood and we looked at some of the houses and stuff. So visualizing those things. And I said, Robert, all you have to do is see yourself in that house, see yourself in that car, see yourself with that lifestyle, and truly believe that you have the ability to get there. That's rule number one. If you can't do that, you know, and he would come in to work and he would kneel down in front of his desk and pray and plead to God to fix his life and help him to be successful. Again, back to what we talked about earlier, that's not faith. That's blind hope on something that he didn't even believe. There's no power in that whatsoever. The power comes when you truly believe that you can achieve that together with God's help. You can achieve whatever it is that you want to. I had a mentor once named Steve of mine, and I was mentoring this other guy named Dallas, and I thought it'd be cool to introduce Dallas to Steve. So we went to Steve's place and we were driving in Steve's Mercedes, and Steve was in the front with Dallas and I was in the back. And Steve asked Dallas, he said, hey, Dallas, tell me. And I was helping Dallas with his company. He said, Dallas, what's your dream? Why are you building this? And Dallas says, you know, that's kind of the problem. And Steve said, what's that? And I thought Steve didn't understand it. He said, yeah, that's the problem. And Steve turned around. He said, no, Paul, that's your problem. I'm like, is my problem that he doesn't have a dream? He goes, yeah. How in the hell are you mentoring him when he doesn't even have a why? So you identify that why. A man who understands why is never at the mercy to somebody who simply understands how. So the visionary leader of the company is the one who truly understands the why behind it. You do that, the how will start falling into place.
Well, we need to talk about how do you do that? Because again, people always ask me, what's my why? You know, I mean, I can throw out a bunch of shit, but how do I know? Like, to me, money is a big one. Like, why? Well, so I could, you know, have everything I want. Why? So I could be happy. Why? Well, because, and I keep going down the journey and there's always another why? And it's like, eventually I'm like, dude, I'm doing fine. I can do better. I know this. I can go out and do this, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure of my why. If someone says truly why, Brad, I would say probably more than likely it's to have freedom.
Yeah.
I want freedom. I don't like being told what to do. And I kind of got used to the good life. Like, I don't want to fly commercial. I want to fly private. Yeah. Why? Have you flown private? That's why. Because it's lovely.
Because we had two queen-size beds on the way to Thailand on a 20-hour flight.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, what do you mean why? Like, you've never done it? Like, that's why. No, you got to find your why. Well, again, my why is the fact that I like to fly private. I need enough money to fly private. That's my why. You know, I could say my kids, they've flown private. That is technically why also, but dude, how do you find your why? That's hard.
Yeah. I think that the key is again, you've got to look at things you don't want until you figure out that you want them. I didn't know that I liked flying in Gulfstreams.
Yeah, but just because your why is you want a jet doesn't mean you're going to get rich.
If you're willing to do the work. I mean, you've got just dreaming isn't going to do anything.
Yeah, you're willing to do the work. That's a key.
Yeah. You've got to have a personal motivation. I tell people that are young entrepreneurs, I say, how many hours did you work last week? I don't know, 12 hours, 40 hours, whatever else it is. If you're not able to discipline yourself to do the things necessary to have a successful company, then you need to go get a job. And some people just aren't cut out. They're not cut out to be an entrepreneur because they need somebody to tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. Back to what you said about freedom. Freedom is super important to me. I would rather own my own hot dog stand than ask somebody when I can go to the bathroom, right?
For sure.
It's just how I think.
That's why I don't understand when people have employees that they're, again, to get a job and move on, great. I had to. We all have to. And there's nothing wrong with the job. You get one until you don't need one. But to get one and stay there, I don't understand. And people say, Brad, how do you say that with your employees that listen? I'll tell them that. Like, I don't understand. Like, dude, I'm the same exact way.
Yeah. I tell my employees, I say, where do you want to be in 5 or 10 years? I'm working for you. Bullshit. No, you don't. Let's figure out how you can magnify what you're doing here to the point where you get so good at it, where you work yourself out of a job. How about that? And I had a mentor in my early 20s who, I was going to be a surgeon. I want to be not a regular doctor, but a surgeon. Not a regular surgeon, but a heart surgeon. Not a regular heart surgeon, but a pediatric cardiologist, one that operates on children. Because I wanted a special, I figured I got one life to live, I'm going to do it. Well, I was 2 months away from taking the MCAT, and I got in a major car accident, and I severed the tendons in my hand. And they didn't know if I'd have the dexterity to be a surgeon. And so they said, well, you can be a regular doctor. I said, I want to be a regular anything. I said, if I'm going to be a garbage man, I'm going to own the dump. That's just how I think, right? I'm going to go big or go home. That's just how it is. And so if I can't be the best of the best of the best at that profession, then I need to change. So I had a mentor, and he said, why do you want to be a doctor anyway? And he was a rich friend of the family. And I said, well, I'll be honest, I want the money. I'll go to school for 12 years so I can drive a Ferrari. And he laughed. He said, Paul, he said, you have a unique gift with people in communication. He said, if you do what I teach you to do, you'd be a millionaire by the time you're 30, and you'll have the time to enjoy it. I said, okay, you know, what do I do? What's the steps? He said, well, first things first, if you're going to be a successful business owner, you've got to learn how to handle rejection. You've got to learn how to sell. Even if you're not the guy that's selling something, you're selling your idea to your employees. You're selling your idea to your investors. You're selling your product to the world. He said that you've got to learn how to handle rejection or learn how to sell. So he suggests I get the highest rejection job I could find. I got a job at a call center. Cold calling, 300 employees selling children's help videos or whatever else, right? So I'm there, and there's 250, 300 employees, and the average person was making 20 sales a week. There's two guys that were making 70. My mentor said, you take those two guys to lunch. You find the best guys in your industry, and you learn from them. You figure out what it is that they're saying, how they're handling objections, et cetera. And I did. I took him to lunch on my dime every day, just learning what they were doing. And he said, secondly, he said, your car needs to be a university on wheels. He said, the most valuable piece of real estate you will ever own is the 6 inches between your ears. He said, you develop that, everything else will work. And so he said, most people spend all their time in their car just blasting the music, whatever else. It was funny. A few years ago, I bought LeBron James's Range Rover. It was gorgeous. He had $60,000 speakers in the back. It was amazing. My kids are like, Dad, what are you going to do? Listen to all of your self-help programs and entrepreneur stuff on your $60,000. I said, the reason I can afford that is because I did listen to that stuff, right? That they joke and they say, Dad, the only reason you like 80s music is that's the last thing you ever heard. Because I took that advice to heart and I was listening to books on tapes. In fact, this people ask me, they say, what's it like to be friends with guys like Tony? You know, what I would give for time with him. I said, what would you ask him if you were with him? I don't know how to be successful. I said, what do you think that you would learn that he's not already putting on his tapes and his books, et cetera? We have access to the greatest minds and the greatest mentors and the greatest success coaches anywhere in the world in your own car. So have a university on wheels. That's the best advice I got besides the charity stuff when I was first starting out. And that changed everything for me because that 6 inches between your ears makes all the difference.
100%. Hey guys, listen, like this stuff isn't rocket science. That's the craziest part. You know, someone said to me, how do I become a millionaire? I don't have anything. I didn't come from this. I didn't have a dad. Ba 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 ba. And again, it's me too. Big deal. So, I mean, I had a dad, but I say, number one, you got to learn to sell something. Why? Because everybody that I know that's successful financially, and that's what most people mistake as success, is money. When that's not only success, you have to have more than that or you're going to end up miserable. But you got to learn to sell something. Everybody I know sells something. You sold something. Your company sold something. Now, again, no, we bought things. Guys, somebody sold something. Quit disagreeing and just start doing. Like, hey, I got to get good at sales. Okay, so you got to sell something. Number two, you got to be willing to do the work. So many people, they're not willing to sacrifice. And I tell people in order, and so I said this the other day, someone said, yeah, I've read that before. Who'd you steal that from? Dude, I made this shit up. This is my saying. If you've ever heard it, it's from me. It's a Brad Lee original. If you don't sacrifice for what you want becomes the sacrifice. I said that like, I don't even remember how many years ago. And someone ran into it. So that's how you know it's good. But I'm not the only one that said that. I'm the only one that said it like that. There are other people in the world that said the same shit different way. The thing with the eye in there where it says, listen with your eyes and you'll see all you need to hear. What does that mean? That's my original. What does that mean? That means actions speak louder than words. I didn't make that shit up. And I'll bet you there's a million people with similar advice, just they said it differently. So I don't know if it's, you got to hear it from the right person. You got to hear it at the right time. But you put you and Tony and all the successful people in a room, they're going to say the same shit. It's not rocket science. You got to learn. You got to develop. You got to seek information. You know, University on Wheels, I hadn't heard that, but that's the same as me. I say seek information. Why? Well, because the reason you're getting what you're getting is because you're doing what you're doing. The reason you're doing what you're doing is because you believe what you believe. So if you need to change your beliefs to change what you're doing, you got to change your beliefs. Well, how do you change your beliefs? You got to get new information. If you get no new information, your beliefs cannot change. So you have to get new information. That's University on Wheels.
Yep.
It's unbelievable, man, because it's not that difficult when you think about it. And then when they listen to two guys talking, they're going to sit there and, yeah, but, oh, dude, they're just trying to sell us a course. You don't sell courses. Yeah, Paul ain't trying to sell you no courses, fool. I always say I don't sell courses. And then they're like, well, you got closer school because this place is a training software that I invented. And so I started out selling training, not courses, and it just evolved to courses. But mainly I have a few courses that, you know, they're cheap and it's sales and it's basic because I'm showing subject matter experts how this works. So it's like, well, if it's so great, why don't you do it? Well, I'd do it. So there you go. Do it like that. So it's an example. I'm not really selling courses. What I'm trying to do is show people how easy it is to get out of the rat race. And the rat race to me is your 9 to 5, you know? Anyway, dude, I could sit here for hours and talk more because I know you have more value. And it's like, man, I want to talk more about entrepreneurship because you've built that. And then I want to talk more about the freaking underbelly of the world and the government and the freaking the creeps that are out there. Because, again, what can we do to stop that? I don't like that at all, at all. To me, it's like, you know, I remember reading that Microfish, that film, and it was telling me stories. These are real stories. These are court documents that I'm reading about what they're doing to little kids. You know, burning them, and they're not even selling them. They're just totally abusing them. You know, selling them for organs. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you, dude? That's somebody's kid. So I always wanted to ask this. Where are they coming from, these kids? Where are they coming from?
Well,
like, does anybody notice them missing? These are children, folks. They're not orphans. They're not like, you know, oh, you just go out to the field and they're, you know, the little, you know, errant kids that are running around. What do they call the feral cats? Like, oh, they're just feral kids we grab. No, somebody has to be missing these children. Where are they coming from?
Two things. Number one, in terms of how we as American parents can be paying attention. Yes, things happen like in the movie Sound of Freedom, where there's a healthy family and a child is taken and put into a container, taken to another. That does happen, but it's very, very, very slim. The majority of trafficked children sleep in their own beds at night. Okay? Now, that's a big aha moment for a lot of parents. They're like, what? So you have to have a relationship with your children where they can very comfortably come to you and say, hey, you know what, Dad, I don't like it when you make me hug Uncle Harry because he touches me weird, or I don't like going to this friend's house because her brother is talking to me about, you know.
But that's sexual abuse. That's not trafficking.
No, it's grooming behaviors. Okay, here's what happens. And a lot of the rescue missions we've done, this was a babysitter who was showing the children pornography and telling this 12-year-old, hey, you know what? You can make a bunch of money if you sleep with an American, whatever else. And then they use fear. They say, okay, I've got these pictures of you doing this. And if you say anything to anybody, including your parents, then we're going to make this public and whatever else. And so then this after-school activity is selling these kids. This happens a lot.
Unbelievable.
Okay. Now, in terms of the children who were taken from their homes, every single day in Latin America. And I've been down there for the last 3 or 4 months building healing retreats and safe houses for the kids. Every single day in every single major city in Latin America, children are disappearing from healthy homes, disappearing and being taken. Why? Because...
They're getting snatched.
Well, and I got an entire room shut down on Clubhouse 3 weeks ago because of this. So you may want to censor this, but I'm just going to tell you like it is. Here's what's happening. Okay. Our border issue should have never been a political issue. It's a human trafficking issue, and it's a big, big problem. Here's what's happening. These children are coming across the border, and they're being taken. They're being controlled by fear. I know where your mom lives. I know where your sister lives. If you say anything to any of these authorities as you come across the border, anything at all, your sister's dead. Do you understand? That's the kind of fear that they're using with these kids, right? And then they bring them across the border, and these kids will have an address and a phone number of a sponsor. And this sponsor, the U.S. government doesn't have the resources to go and vet all of the sponsors of all of these kids. They said, okay, you got a phone number, whatever, here, using your taxpayer dollars to put a trafficked, taken, kidnapped child on a plane, on a bus, and to their new trafficker. Why? Because they can earn a whole bunch more money selling those kids into prostitution rings here in the U.S. than they can in Honduras. And it's happening everywhere, everywhere. There's hundreds of thousands of undocumented children who have been brought across. You really think that all of those kids don't have parents somewhere in Latin America? Really?
Or are they Latin kids in the country?
Yeah, a lot of them were Latin kids that were down there. There are U.S. kids that are taken. You know, in one of our undercover operations, we were sitting there negotiating with them, and we were finding more about their operation. And I've got this business plan that I'm putting together with them. And I said, okay, what does it cost to get a little girl, boy from Honduras or from Haiti or whatever else, you know, $2,500, $3,000 is what it costs them to bring that child in. What does it cost for a little blonde American girl? $25,000, right? It's 10 times the amount because they have to pay for transportation and getting them down here. But it's part of the business. Why? Because they can sell that child for a lot more than they could the local kid that was down there. So it's happening in our own backyards. It's happening everywhere. But you've got to have a relationship with your kids where they can very comfortably come to you and say if something weird is going on at school, et cetera. But here's the thing. It's not just trafficking that's our biggest problems. It's the fact that one in every four children have been a victim of sexual violence as a child, right?
When you say sexual violence, again, I don't want people to confuse that. Like, you think violence is, you know, violence. You're
sexual abuse in some way.
Abuse is a better word.
They're being raped. I call it violence. If it's a 6-7-year-old child and they're being abused by their uncle, that's violence. I will get violent with that uncle because that's violence. And he's not beating him up. Right.
But that's the thing. That's the confusion. I know, but like if I'm listening to sexual violence, well, my kids aren't going through that. Why? Because they're fine, but it doesn't mean their uncle. Their uncle listens to this show, so I'm not talking about you. Okay, but an uncle, okay, decides to, you know,
molest
groom them or mess with them and talk them into it. And it's not like, dude, a kid's not that mature. They don't know they're doing this and that wrong.
Yeah.
So it may not be violent is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's still abuse.
Which is why it's so hidden, which is why as parents don't see it sometimes. We don't see that slight change of behavior in our 11-year-old daughter where we're thinking, oh, she's just going through, you know, some hormonal changes. No, there's a chance that she's dealing with some other issues. And if she doesn't have a healthy relationship with you as her father or her mother, then those things can get buried. And here's what happens. When we rescue these kids in Latin America or other countries.
Why there? Why not here?
Yeah, that's a whole other story. We run into all kinds of ego problems with the government here. I mean, we had a situation in Hawaii where the head of the FBI in Hawaii had come to us and said, hey, we're pretty sure there's a lot of trafficking that's being done, but we don't know who to trust here. We think that the police are involved in some other things. So they wanted us as a private organization to come in and do some of the work. Well, we put together the team. We're going to go do all the undercover. And boom, we got shut down. The whole operation got shut down by the feds in D.C. Why? We can't let a private organization do our work. Well, then do your work, guys. Do your work.
Well, what do you mean? Maybe because they're the customer.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you... here's the thing.
And if with, they with, are the customer, that's why, Jeffrey what do Epstein, people do?
With the Jeffrey Epstein deal, if you want to control, if you want to control a vote of a senator, a congressman, a judge, if you want to control them for life, get that degree of blackmail on them. Get them on video with some 13-year-old, 12-year-old, a guy, a dude, whatever it is.
But don't leave it on a laptop at a repair center.
Well, if you do, it doesn't matter. As long as you have the right people in control, then you can make sure that nobody gets that laptop, right?
Yeah.
So, yes, see, the corruption goes to the top.
Yeah, but that just, it, like, you ever see stories where, you know, the police aren't doing anything because they were told to stand down, and it's like, wait a minute. You took an oath to uphold the law. The law is in writing. If a police officer, if I'm a police officer and the chief of police tells me to abandon my oath, my answer is going to be no. Now, yes, I got fired. But as soon as a chief is responsible for causing that oath to be abandoned, we should immediately get rid of the chief. Why? Because, dude, that is the chief of police. He's there to make sure everybody's respecting the oath. Same thing with politicians. As soon as the politician does anything against the Constitution, immediately that politician should be out, emergency election, whatever the case is, get a new politician in there. Why? Because, dude, these things are obvious. But again, when you have everybody in the house, if you will, backroom deal, having no term limit, having freaking lawyers, they're all lawyers,
yeah,
so they know, well, that word could mean, and we could find this hole and that hole. Dude, we're screwed. The only way we're not screwed is to literally, it's the fox guarding the hen house, and until we understand that, guys, we're screwed.
We could talk for hours on that
and
subject.
Nothing will change, yeah, until something changes.
Yeah,
because again, like, you look at the old Constitution signing and you see all these old dudes signing the Constitution because they had gray wigs. But if you look at their ages, were you aware that, like, when John Hancock signed the Constitution, he might have been in his 30s?
Well,
there were, like, I forget, a lot of them were 20s, in their 20s. Why is everybody in the government old, old, old?
Because they've been there forever, because, and they've got these backdoor deals that keep them there.
And why would they give that up?
Yeah.
Because if they give that up, well, now they have no more power. Well, you would think that it would be a common sense rule of the people that, hey, if you go up there and make laws, you have to live by the same laws. And I don't know if everybody's aware, but, like, they don't have to live by the same rules. Isn't that common sense? That's stupid.
Yeah.
So why is it allowed? Anyway, I'm gonna have to have you back, because, dude, we got a lot more to talk about, and this is going to be, you know, one of the longest episodes already. And I keep bouncing into the child trafficking stuff because it's so interesting, and I want to bring attention to it. But again,
that's how
I mean,
we get censored.
That's what's going to keep this episode. Well, you know, one time I brought a guy in here. We talk more about alcoholism than child trafficking, but we were talking about child trafficking in Hollywood and all this. They kicked it off of YouTube. And this is like, dude, listen, I don't understand. Why? Is it because the powers that be are the customers, and they're not going to allow it to get out, so we're just screwed?
Yeah.
So then I think, okay, then it's the parents' job. Pay attention. Well, a lot of times, dude, and I ain't talking about the kid that gets snatched and missing. Parents are freaking out. They want their kid back, obviously. I'm talking about the ones that are selling their children, because there are parents that sell the children.
A lot.
And that's where, like, I call it a factory. You just start making them, knowing full well, dude, you know, this one's worth X, this one's worth X. Like, what's a liver worth? You know, what is a 10-year-old worth in the sex rings?
Millions.
And it's like, oh my God, dude, this is, number one, sad. Number two, it's almost like disheartening, because, like, what do you do? You know,
yeah.
you got to focus on what you can control. And it's like, sometimes I'm like, oh, I can't control that. I can't do anything, but we can do something. Yeah. You know, and there's a little girl, there's a little boy somewhere right now, young, in a bad situation, that would get help if we all would stand up and start saying, hey, where are these kids at? You know, why are we letting these kids across the border? You know,
and even in the United States, there are hundreds of thousands of children every year that are disappearing.
They just go missing.
They go missing,
and no one cares.
Yeah,
no one mentions it.
Yeah, if they're not from a wealthy, affluent family that's going to really make a big fuss, then it doesn't matter.
Well, it's the wealthy, affluent families, according to what you said earlier, that are down there humping the kids anyway.
Yeah.
Isn't it the big, rich, arrogant?
Well, it's everybody. It's everybody that's just, you know, broken in some way. That's
well, they're broken, but you said earlier, like, a lot of times it's these wealthy people.
That's why I worked well undercover.
Yeah, so basically all the wealthy people are sadistic perverts.
Not all of us. You and I are wealthy.
Dude, I wouldn't consider myself wealthy yet. Like, dude, I still got work to do, bro. Like, dude, I can't, like, if I retired, I would have to be wise and conservative to go fine. Mm-hmm. I cannot retire right now, stop, and fly private everywhere I go and donate millions to saving kids. And I can't. I will.
Soon.
But that's why I like to talk more about entrepreneurship. Why? Because, dude, here I got a company. I guarantee you this is a $1 billion company. But I'm like you and your partner. Like, I can only bring it so far, and clearly I've only brought it so far. But there's companies worth, you know, valued at billions that do what we do. Well, they don't really, but they claim to. That's garbage. But whoever was running that company knew how to raise this and do that.
Well, you know, one thing I love about you and what you're doing here, I'm a huge advocate of making money while doing good, while spreading that wealth and that wisdom and that everything around you. You want to make $1 million, create $1 million worth of value in the lives of others, maybe $2 million worth of value in the lives of others. You want to make $1 billion, then create $1 billion or $2 billion worth of value in the lives of other people. And that's what you're doing. I have a really hard time with guys who make a whole bunch of money and, you know, they threw a bunch of the right crypto thing at the right time. Okay, yeah, maybe you were lucky, maybe you're smart, but the guys that I really respect are the ones that create systems that are providing real value. And what does that real value look like? It's a value in the terms of multiples, right? The people that are going through your courses, the people that are listening to you, they are getting multiples in value. Why? Because they can take their company from earning $10,000 a month to $100,000 a month while using those principles. So this ripple effect of value that you're creating is creating billions of dollars worth of value in the lives of other people as a whole, for all of humanity. So yes, you should deserve to make tens of millions of dollars a year. One of the things that
people, well, I already do that. I want to make billions of dollars a year.
Good. That's perfect. And the thing that people need to change, especially as entrepreneurs, sorry, I'm doing this little thing, but this is super powerful, right? If guys don't have their mind right about money, then they're going to sabotage their own success.
Maybe that's me, though.
And so here's what happens. If you're a good person, right? You're a charitable person. You're good. You don't want to cause harm in the world. And if there's any part of you at all that believes we live in a world of scarcity, meaning if you're going to make $1 million, then $1 million has to come out of the pockets of other people in order for you to make that million. Or if you're going to make $1 billion, $1 billion has to come out. If you believe that in any way, shape, or form, then subconsciously you will sabotage your success because you're a good person and you don't want to take that. You need to truly embrace the truth that we live in a world of abundance. I love the English language that uses the word to make money, because we're literally creating money. We're literally, and the example is this: there's 10 men on an island, 10 families, and every day those men go fishing and they get enough fish to feed their families. Well, then Brad and Paul, two guys there that have some creative energy, they say, you know what, we're going to come up with an idea that's better than just fishing every day. So we come up with this idea of this net. Together with our wives, we sew that thing, and boom, we go out, and now Brad and Paul are able to catch enough fish to feed the entire island. Now, the problem we have at that point is 80% unemployment, right? Those other 8 men don't have a job anymore. And our current administration would tax Paul and Brad 80% of their fish just to be able to pay, that make everybody else eat. A well-functioning system Those other eight men, one would get better at building boats, one would get better at building huts, one would get better at educating the children, and lifestyle as a whole would increase for the entire island because of the creativity of two entrepreneurs that created a net. That's the world we live in today. Every single one of us, I don't care if you live in a one-bedroom apartment, if you've got a microwave and air conditioner, you have a lifestyle better than kings did 2,000 years ago. Why? Because of creative entrepreneurs over 1,000 years that came up with new ideas for a net, right? So when you understand economics from that perspective, the problem is you open up a book on economics, the very definition of economics in most cases is the division of scarce resources, which is a fallacy. There's enough resources where every one of us could have all the food we could ever eat, all the clothes we could ever... We could all have a private jet if that's what we wanted. But we believe that we live in a world of scarcity. And once we change that belief system, then boom, life opens up and you can create a world of abundance for yourself and for the world around you.
So my question, which I already have the answer, is how do you do that?
How do you create? How do you change your mindset?
How do you change your beliefs?
It's not even a belief. This is fact.
Yeah, how do you change it? Well, you just said all you got to do is this.
You need to truly embrace the idea of a world of abundance. If you're a scarcity mindset person, you're going to live in a scarcity world.
Okay, let's pretend they agree. So how do they change it? If they're scarcity mindset, how do you change that?
It's looking at the world around you and realizing that our minds... Here's something that I do.
You want me to give you a hack?
Yeah.
New information.
Yeah.
You got to get it. See, this is my point. Like, dude, my beliefs will never change until I get new information. So this is new information they're getting. They choose not to believe it. They can choose to not do anything with it. But again, to change your beliefs, which is what you said, you have to get and understand that there's an abundance in this world. And I might have to realize there's more abundance. Why? Because like I've done pretty well, but I'm not a billionaire. So like if that's all I got to do is think there's abundance, I already do in my mind. But maybe deep down subconsciously, I still have some sort of scarcity when it comes to that. Like, well, maybe I'm never going to get a billion because like I haven't done anything. I didn't graduate. I didn't do this. You know, I'm a loser according to my, you know, number one, ex-wife's sister. Number two, you know, a lot of my family, you know, I was going to end up in jail, never worth anything. So maybe I beat it to here, but I'm never going to get to here because I have that same problem. So I always tell people, because people, well, what about you? I don't claim I'm anything special yet. Maybe that's my problem. I need new information. So my advice to people is you need new information or you need new relationships. Why? Because I don't know someone I need to know or I don't know something I need to know. But if you just keep shaking hands and you keep learning, you're going to end up where you want to be if you know where it is. Because again, if you don't know where you want to go, how are you supposed to get there?
Exactly.
It's crazy. So new information was the answer
that
I'd give.
Yep.
That's how you change it. How do you change your beliefs? There's only one way to change your beliefs. New information.
Develop that 6 inches between your ears.
Like if you told your kid from the day it was born that fire did not burn, I'll bet you that kid will get burnt because he will believe you until he gets new information when he sticks the hand in the fire. And then he won't believe you even though you're his father. He will stop what he believed before instantly with that new information. But if he put his hand in the fire and it didn't burn, guess what? He'd believe it didn't burn.
Yeah.
And maybe somewhere between faith and belief, you know, I don't know the difference. All I do know is according to scripture, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you would say move mountains and they would move.
What does that look like? You know, it's that belief. A mustard seed is teeny tiny and the tree is massive. That's what it is. You've got to look in the mirror and see that massive tree. You got to fake it till you make it. I was broken. I was looking in the mirror and I was shaving a millionaire. Right? I was my bank account didn't say that, but the mirror, I was looking at myself and I'm shaving a millionaire. I'm seeing, I like myself. I believe in myself. I can do this. We're going to be a $1 billion fund. It's all belief. It's all seeing what you want to. Getting that information about what it's really going to take to get there. You can't just believe your way to success. That's not going to happen. You got to work your ass off. You've got to put in the time. You've got to create the relationships. But all of the forces of the universe will conspire to help you to create what it is that you truly believe you can create.
All right. Now, again, last question, because you said all the forces of the universe. Beforehand, you said God. So which one is it?
It's the same.
Is it?
So if that's the same thing. Okay, so God is in everything. God's in this water.
So if that's the case, then I've always had a question of, if God loves these children so much and he's real, why is he allowing these children to be trafficked and killed and mutilated and humped and abused?
That's a really good question.
Why is he allowing it if he loves them so much?
Because the one gift.
Isn't he all powerful?
Yeah.
Couldn't he just go?
The one gift that we all have.
And cause everybody to be good?
The gift that we all have is freedom of choice.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use my freedom of choice to ensure that that guy's freedom of choice doesn't affect that child's freedom of choice. And so we all have freedom of choice. And it's part of the
why
expansion.
Doesn't God stop him?
Because that it's not going to allow us. How can you be a hero if somebody isn't a villain? How can you create value in the world if there wasn't value already there? You have to have that. There's a polarity in all things. And part of the expansion of our own consciousness, of our own life, of everything, comes with that polarity. Comes from the fact that we wouldn't enjoy the light if we didn't know what darkness was. We wouldn't enjoy health if we didn't understand sickness. And so yeah, there has to be both. But here's the thing: the suffering of these children, we think this is some catastrophic. This lifetime is such a teeny tiny little part of eternity. And it's part of this growth and this progression. So yeah, a lot of times in the beginning, I'd get mad. I'm like, you know what? Why isn't God just throw a lightning bolt down there?
Yeah, or cause them to all go limp permanently.
Yeah, exactly. I think castration is the best option. I really do. I think that most governments should adopt something like that. Just chop it off. Have the laws so severe that nobody thinks twice about that. They're like, oh, hell no.
I would vote for that right now.
Absolutely, I'd vote for that.
And again, whoever didn't,
yeah,
guilty.
Yeah.
I always said, hey, anybody who votes, like and again, this is the media saying, I don't know if this is true. It cannot possibly be true, but I've been hearing they're trying to vote laws that it's no longer called pedophilia. It's called
a minor attracted adult. That's bullshit.
Yeah. And it's totally okay. It's just a choice. Just like, bestiality. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Like you shouldn't be humping animals. You shouldn't be humping children. And you said earlier something that I wanted to interject, because there's religions where one of the prophets married a 9-year-old. And it's like, if you think that's the religion, that's the truth.
Yeah.
The 9-year-old's okay. Well, back then it was okay. I don't believe in any God that's okay.
Mm-mm.
And I don't believe it's okay. And I don't condone that. And I'm not going to be anywhere near that. So again, anybody out there listening, you want to help? That man's out there helping every day. And if you want to help him or join him, you know how to get a hold of him. One more time.
Go to the Child Liberation Foundation, liberatechildren.org, or go to liberatinghumanity.com.
And then your book is coming out. How do they pre-order that?
You can go to liberatinghumanity.com, and you can pre-order the book right there. It'll be out in the next couple months. And the first one is on the Sound of Freedom movie. It's the Child Liberation series, book one, and a bunch of mothers. But the one coming out later this year that talks about, it's called Are You Listening?, which, with my hand on my heart, not on my ear. Because that's how I was led to the right people in my companies, to the identifying where the children were every single day. And I have hundreds of examples of using that connection to everything around us, realizing that we're not physical beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a physical experience. And when you see it from that standpoint, you can control so much of your life. In your business, in your relationships, in your charity work, etc.
That's huge. What's your Instagram?
It's just liberating.humanity.
At liberating.humanity. Are you on Instagram?
I am.
My team did everything but that.
Yeah, yeah. Instagram, I mean, I was zero a year ago because I was undercover for 10 years. I had nothing. I have like 120,000 followers, so not huge, but it's grown pretty good. And since I decided to go public, my team has said that over 400 million total views and eyeballs on all of the podcasts I've been on and the little shorts and everything else. So I'm super grateful for all of the people that are saying, hey, you know what? Yeah, this is a dark subject, but I need to hear about it so that I can make a difference, so I can make the world a better place.
Amen. Hey, and by the way, guys, go follow him on Instagram or all the social media at liberatinghumanity.com. I'm going to try to get him back for another episode. Write in or comment on the episode what you want me to ask him next time, what direction you want me to take. A lot of people always bitch and complain that, you know, you didn't talk about this. It's like, dude, that's because I'm just having a conversation. I forget that this is even a podcast and people are going to listen to it. That's why a lot of people are like, you keep interrupting the guests. Well, that's because real conversations, that's what you do. I'm not trying to think, let me get this full answer out for them. I'm like, you give me enough of an answer, and I'm good on that. But what about that? So anyway, you guys tell me on the second episode of Paul Hutchinson what you guys want me to drill into more business, more nastiness, more problems, or a blend like this one. This one was a good blend, I think. But anyway, I appreciate you coming in,
Brad. I'm super grateful,
folks. Grateful. As always, till next time, keep it real.